The exotic and otherworldly sounds of traditional Cambodian pinpiat music to set the tone here as we get ready to embark on a special hour of The Signal. For centuries, this ensemble music was played to accompany elaborate dance troupes, to honor Cambodian kings and royal courts, to chronicle the country's history, to aid in prayers and funerals, and to commune with supernatural spirits. Our program today, a visit with Master Chum Nyek, a man who, as we'll hear, literally owes his life to music. Welcome to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined this week by Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy, as we get ready to share some music and conversation recorded with Chum Nyek during a recent afternoon at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. The area is a nexus of Cambodian immigrants. And Cliff, as you and I learned, our guest is known in his community by the honorific title Master Chum. Cliff, welcome, as always, to the program.
Thanks, Aaron. It's great to be here.
Cliff, as our program unfolds over the course of the hour, we're going to learn more about Master Chum's struggles to survive during the horrors of the Pol Pot regime. We're going to hear about how he made it to the U.S. and how his life changed once he got here. But first, let's start at the beginning and let listeners get acquainted with Master Chum. I'm going to play a few minutes here of conversation. I should say our guest's English is admirable. But for the sake of radio clarity, we've put a voiceover in place here. That being explained, we're going to hear now about Master Chum's childhood and his early musical influences.
I was born June 1st, 53, in the Battambang province.
I was born June 1st, 1953, in the Battambang province.
My mom and my dad, he's not a musician.
My mom and dad, they weren't musicians. My father was a furniture maker. My grandfather, he was a music teacher. But I didn't live with my mom and dad. When I was born, my grandfather took me to another place. When I was growing up, I didn't know that my mom and dad were my mom and dad. When I was 18 years old, my grandmother told me, "I'm not your real mom. I'm your grandmother." I was so upset, I cried.
I'm so upset, you know, cry.
I always called my mom and dad brother and sister when I saw them. I was used to that. Even now, I call my father brother. I cannot call him father.
I cannot call father.
I had one sister who was born before me, and she died. So my grandparents didn't believe that my mom and dad could take care of another kid. They thought if I stayed with my mom and dad, I'd end up dead. So they took me to another place when I was 7 days old.
They said like a 7 day. After 7 day, they took it. My grandfather, he's a musician, but you know.
My grandfather was a musician. He was my grandfather on my mother's side. See, in Cambodia, they don't want women to learn music. My mom liked music a lot, but my grandfather never let her learn music. In my country, when a lady plays music, the men gather around her, and her father and mother, they don't like it.
The father and mother, they don't like it. It's not like here.
My grandfather had taught music for a long time. In my province, we didn't have music schools, but my grandfather built a big house and used part of it as a music school.
You know, in my country, we don't have the school.
My grandfather didn't want me to learn music. He said he wanted me to go to school to become a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. But I used to steal chopsticks from my grandmother's kitchen, and I'd always play them on the table, on the ground. When my grandfather was teaching music upstairs, I'd play along on the chopsticks. When I was maybe 8 years old, I asked my grandfather, "Why won't you let me learn music?" My grandfather had a cousin who was a teacher too, but he didn't have as many students as my grandfather. He taught me how to play the big drum. He said, "Sit down on my knee and I'll teach you how to play this." The song I learned is called Klom. He said, "Here's an easy way to play it." Then we went back to my grandfather's house so I could play for him. But when I played, he snored.
He snored.
My grandfather asked his cousin, "Why'd you teach the boy? I don't want him to play." But his cousin told him, "He's smart. It takes a smart person to learn this music."
He don't want to taught me too, but he lazy to play. I later time he say, "Ah." Oh. He told my grandfather, he's smart. You're supposed to push him, you know, to learn the music.
Cambodian master musician Chum Nyek, remembering his uphill battle to be allowed to learn music as a child. Aaron Henkin here with Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy, sharing some recordings from our recent visit to the Gaithersburg, Maryland home of Master Chum, and a cliff. From those humble beginnings, this man would grow into a master player of a traditional music form that's known as pinpiat. And as we get ready to tour through the constituent instruments of the pinpiat ensemble, let me ask you to put this music in some context for us.
Sure. Pinpiat music is part of Khmer classical music and or Cambodian classical music. And unlike classical music that we're familiar with from Europe, there's no musical notation. This is all music that exists in people's heads. And this is part of the reason that Chum Nyek is such an important figure, is that his brain contains all of this information, all of these songs that are it's really music of importance. It's music that would be found in temples. It was music that would be found in courts. Music that conveyed a cultural sense of importance.
And as we'll hear later in the program, it also was believed to help answer prayers.
Yes, this is sacred music as well.
So this music is comprised of very exotic instruments, at least to Western ears and eyes. The sampo, the roniet eye, the roniet tongue, kong tom, kong to, chung chap, and srilai. And we're about to get a lesson in all those constituent elements.
They respect for the sampo. You know why they respect the sampo? They say that
people have a special respect for the sampo because it plays the rhythm. In Cambodia, this instrument is called the teacher. Whenever a musician or a dancer begins formal training, they're called on to honor this drum with a ceremony, with incense. Students sometimes ask me, why is there so much respect for the sampo? I used to wonder that too, when I was a student. My teacher said, you don't understand. If you don't have a beat, you can't play music.
We don't have the beat, we cannot play the music. This one is important for the dancer because, you know, the people play sampo.
This instrument is important for the dancers. Sampo players need to watch the dancers and, as the dancers change their movements, the drum beat changes with the dance movement.
It's the drum that they change too, like. They move, go back. Come back again. When you see the dancer, when they move something, go in the music. This one they call Cambodia. They call Runyet Ai.
In Cambodia, they call this instrument Runyet Ai. In America, it's called a xylophone. There are 21 keys on this.
Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. But is that this one?
We have a scale of seven notes.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si.
I can make these, but this one is from Cambodia.
This one is called Runyet Tung, bass xylophone. The Runyet Tung, we have a...
This instrument is called Runyet Tung. It's like the Kong Tom, 16 pitches, but we play it differently.
The Kong Tom. This one is called Kong Tom, but Kong, we have two kinds of Kong. We have one.
This instrument is called Kong Tom. There are two kinds of these here. This is the bigger one. The way I play this is not the same as how I play the xylophone.
Do like this. Thank you. this one is called kong to. It's a small kong cycle.
This instrument is called the kong to. It's a smaller version of the kong tom.
The sound different too. Okay, you know, it's the kong to. It's I think the easy for me, but you know, the people learn.
The kong to is easy for me to play, but people say it's hard to learn. The trick is balance. You have a mallet in each hand, and you can't have one hand that hits heavier than the other. If one side is louder than the other, it doesn't sound good. They call this instrument chung chop. When you play this, you hold one in each hand and you hit them together, like this.
Open and go. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. When the people sing.
This is a kind of oboe that has six finger holes. See here? It looks like there should be seven, right? But there's no seventh hole there, only six. This is an amazing instrument. My teacher could never play this. My grandfather could, but not my teacher. Not a lot of people can. It's really hard to play. We call this instrument srilai.
You see that I didn't just hold like this. We can make the two sound.
See, with just this one hole, I can make two sounds.
The song is called Soy Plain.
I think what's amazing about that, listeners will hear that and realize that there's no break in between the notes. You're doing a method of breathing that allows you to play constantly. Talk about how you do that.
The first thing is my grandfather, it didn't.
The way I first learned that technique was when my grandfather took me to the water. I went in so my mouth was underwater, but my nose was above water. I had to breathe and blow bubbles at the same time, like this.
Like, something like that. Usually in the morning in my Cambodia, in Cambodia, they go to the river.
Usually in the morning, the people in Cambodia would go down to the river and do their morning exercises. We musicians, we had special exercises we do in the water too. For xylophone playing, we do a hand exercise for speed and power. And of course, for the oboe, we do our breathing exercises. But I haven't really played this oboe for a long time. When I was young, I played it really well because I had lung power. I could play for an hour and a half without stopping. But I'm older now, and I have a hernia in my abdomen, so the doctor says I'm not supposed to play this anymore. I can play it maybe 5 or 10 minutes, tops. Not for an hour, though.
A little peculiar, perhaps, to our Western ears, but those sounds are the ingredients of a powerful Cambodian traditional music called pin piat. The sounds of a quadruple reeded oboe, wooden xylophones, brass gongs, hand drums, and ceramic castanets. This is an arrangement which, as you'll hear when it's all put together, can sound utterly hypnotic. Thank you. You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined this hour by Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy. And a Cliff, that's a CD recording we're hearing right now, actually of our guest, Master Chumniek, playing every instrument of the pinpiat, overdubbing himself to recreate the feel of an ensemble, yes?
Yeah, it's unusual to find somebody who can play so many instruments and to play so many instruments well. Even a very good musician on any given instrument, you know, to be able to master really an entire orchestra is remarkable. The other thing too is that, I mean, this is a musical form that's over 1,000 years old, and it gets passed on from generation to generation. And so if you think of that as a cultural conversation that's going on over 1,000 years, all down into this one person, you know, the Cambodian society was completely disrupted. That's not even a fair word.
Well, it was very systematically stamped out in the mid-1970s with the advent of the Khmer Rouge regime and Pol Pot.
Right. And so, you know, the Pol Pot regime, because this music was so closely associated with things that it wanted to destroy, you know, things like temples, things like...
religion, family.
Right.
Family units.
Royalty. Yeah. This was a threat. And so by destroying the musicians who contained all of this heritage and information, it was an effective way of kind of... In their opinion, an effective way of destroying the past and starting over again.
The Pol Pot, they didn't respect anything about the music in there.
The Pol Pot regime didn't approve of the music because they didn't approve of our gods and spirits. We who played that music, we had the respect of our people, and Pol Pot didn't like that. They didn't want anyone to play the pinpiat because the pinpiat used to be played for Cambodian kings and noble people. They played in the temples for the monks. Pol Pot didn't respect that. Pinpiat music was part of a ceremony with dancers, done for kings and important people.
They don't want it.
When they used to gather to pray for something in Cambodia, if they didn't have the pinpiat, they couldn't pray. For example, in Cambodia, we would go through droughts with no rain, so we couldn't plant rice. But the people would gather, and the pinpiat would play, and they believed that it would make the rain come. If there was a war, or people were fighting, or people were sick, they'd invite the pinpiat to play. Now, I don't know if they do that anymore.
Now I don't know that.
So it sounds like this music was believed to have a real power to change nature, to change things about the world, to help answer prayers.
Yeah, so they believe like that. Okay, you know, when they...
Yeah. I think that when people all believed in it together, things happened. For example, if there was a couple that wanted to have a baby but they were having trouble conceiving, they invited the pinpiat to play. When they eventually had the baby, they said, oh yeah, it was the pinpiat.
When we had the baby, they play, oh yeah.
Cambodian master pinpiat musician Chumniek on the history of his traditional music, why it posed such a threat to Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime of radical communist reform in the 1970s. You're tuned to a special edition of The Signal, co-produced with Maryland Traditions, music and conversation recently recorded with Chumniek at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. After the break, Master Chum's personal struggle to survive during the tyrannical reign of Pol Pot, how his musical skills saved his life more than once, and how he eventually found his way here to the U.S. Stay with us. Here's Cambodian music master Chumniek remembering a lullaby his grandmother used to sing him when he was a little boy back home in Battambang province.
ឯអើយឲ្យប្រាត់នៅពីបងទៅ
Welcome back to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined this hour by Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy. Cliff and I recently spent a day visiting with Master Chum at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He toured us through the traditional instruments of the Pinpiat Ensemble, an exotic array of drums, xylophones, and gongs. And he shared his life story with us, his childhood as a village boy, growing up in his musician grandfather's house, his intense musical studies, and his promising career as a professional musician playing traditional Pinpiat music. All that promise would hit a wall, though, with the ascendancy of Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime in the mid-1970s. And Cliff, as we get ready to hear about how radically life changed for Master Chum, let me ask you to talk a bit about why he resisted the enticement of taking a relatively easy route, which would have been to offer his musical talents to the new ruling party and effectively become a house musician for the new regime.
The Khmer Rouge, like a lot of, I guess, totalitarian governments, tried to harness folklore, traditional music and dance, and to kind of reshape it into this nationalistic form that reinforced their power. I think that this is probably most well known with Hitler or with Stalin. Chumnyek was presented with this opportunity to kind of perform this new nationalistic Cambodian music for the regime, and he had absolutely no respect for it, and he said no. And what's amazing to me is that musicians are notoriously, regardless of genre, style, nationality, musicians are notoriously opinionated about music that they don't like, don't respect. But it's really unusual to find somebody who's presented with a life or death choice over what they're going to play and how they're going to play. And Chumnyek is somebody who really stood by his beliefs and said, no, I will not do this, even though it means a life of hard labor. It's incredible.
Let's turn things over now to Master Chum and hear just how life changed for him during that time.
My grandfather passed away in the day the Pol Pot's coming.
My grandfather passed away the same day Pol Pot took power. My grandmother had passed away 1 week earlier.
1 week before my grandfather. And my grandfather, he's passed away in the day in the Pol Pot coming.
That must have been difficult and crazy time for you. So many changes all of a sudden in your life, in your personal life, and then the life of the entire country.
Yeah, that time is crazy, and feels so bad, you know.
Yeah, that time was crazy. It's still so bad for me to think about that time. They moved me away from my instruments and from my town and took me to go to a work farm far away from home.
Far away from home.
And that's when, as you were saying, you were invited to play music for Pol Pot regime, and you said no thank you.
Yeah, it's the one guy, he's older than me 1 year.
Yeah. This other guy in the camp, he was a year older than me, and he said, why don't you play music for them, like I'm doing? I can invite you along to play with me. I said, no, I don't want to play my music for them. They've taken me away from my home.
Move me far, far, far away from that town.
Tell me about this work camp. What was life like there? I mean, you would wake up. What would you do?
The farmer, and they plant the rye.
They had us doing farm work, planting rice. We'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. For breakfast, they gave us what they called rice soup, but it was really just a bowl of water with 10 or 15 grains of rice in it. They worked us like animals.
It's so hard, and later, like 2-3 months, I think it. It's my body so thin. You know?
It was so hard. And after 2 or 3 months, my body was so thin. One day, I was so sick and hungry, and the general of the work camp came around asking, who can play music for us? At that point, I said to myself, maybe I ought to play music for them, because I needed food so badly. At that time, I'd been moved far away from home, and I didn't have any of my instruments. All I had was what they call a khloi. It's a small flute. I had it in my pack, and I said, okay, let me try this. That night when the general was nearby, I played the cloy, and he said to his lieutenant, who's playing that song? What instrument is that? It's so beautiful. Ask him to come and see me. So the next day, the lieutenant asked me to come with him to see the general. Now, usually, when people are asked to come to see the general, it means they're going to be killed. In my group, I had 15 or 20 people around me that day saying, oh, I'm so sorry that you have to go, Mr. Chum. Well, they took me to see the general, and he asked me, were you the one playing the flute last night? I said, yes. He asked his lieutenant to go and get my flute, my cloy, and he asked me, can you play a song for me? I said, yes. I played, and he said, oh, you're so good, man. Then he told his people to give me some food. He said, you're so skinny. And he gave me 3 plates of food. I almost died. I was so full. Then he asked me to play one more song. I played for him.
I played for him, you know, and like...
Do you remember the song you played for them?
Yeah, I remember the song.
Could you play it for us? You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR, where you're listening to the story of Cambodian master musician Chum Nyek, recorded recently at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Master Chum's musical talent lent him some semblance of reprieve during the brutal conditions he endured in the work camps of Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime. But reprieve, in those circumstances, was a relative term.
You know, later time we had one people in like my friend, but I don't know him before, you know, but they worked together.
There was another time, a little later. I had a friend I'd met in the camp. We stayed together there. And one day he was so sick from starvation that he couldn't get up to work. The bosses said, he's just very lazy. Don't give him any food. That day, he was driven to madness. I went back to work around 11 o'clock that day, and I heard gunshots.
The gun? I say, oh, what happened? He took the
My friend had grabbed a gun from one of the guards and he started shooting. But he was so weak, he couldn't aim the gun. He just hit the trees with bullets. Then he tried to run away, but the Pol Pot soldiers killed him.
They killed him and he died.
After they killed him, they gathered together all his friends, including me, 6 of us. They told us they were going to kill us too, because we were friends with him. So they dug a hole, a mass grave, and they made us get in the hole. Then they waited while one of them went to their general. They needed him to give the okay to kill us. The general asked his soldier, what are the people's names? The soldier gave the other guy's names, and then he said my name.
They call me the Takloy.
They all called me Takloy. That means old man flute. The general said, oh, why are you going to kill Takloy? Don't kill him. I want to keep him around. I like it when he plays the cloy for me. So they spared my life, and the other guys too, but they sent me to an even worse camp where the work was much harder.
To another place is the bad place. When they moved me to, the bad place.
When they moved me to the bad place, I almost died. So they took me to a hospital that happened to be near where the general was. When I got better, the people at the hospital sent me out to climb a tree and chop some timbers for firewood. The tree branched out over a bicycle path. the general came by on the path and sat under the tree to take a rest. He looked up in the tree and said, "Who's that up there in the tree?" I said, "It's me." He said, "Oh, Takloy."
He said, "Oh, Takloy." He said, "Yeah, I'm Takloy."
"You look so sickly, like a ghost. Come down from there." And he gave me some food to eat. About a week later, they picked me and some other people from the hospital, and they trained us on how to administer medical injections. They assigned me to an area where the patients were on the verge of death. Every night, at least 6 people died, and there was no one there whose job it was to take care of the bodies. So I did everything.
One day, they sent me to the daycare, you know, the children very, very sick.
One day, they sent me to deliver some medicine to a nearby daycare center for children. There was a child there who was very sick, so I rode a bike about 15 or 20 minutes to get there. There were actually a lot of sick children there, so I got to work giving them medicine. I heard a woman's voice say, "Who's that taking care of the children?" I looked up and saw the woman who would become my wife. I said, "Me. I'm the one taking care of these children." I told her what she needed to do in the way of follow-up care for the kids, and then I left. Later that day, once I'd gone back to my place, I said to myself,
"That lady, what happened to my heart?"
"That lady, what happened to my heart? I've seen other ladies at work, and my heart's never felt like that. When I saw her, my heart beat so fast."
My heart is so fast.
I think maybe 6 months later, the Pol Pot regime actually gave me 2 weeks off from my work to reward me for becoming a valued and skilled worker. They came to me and some other men, and they said, "Who's interested in getting married?" They told us that if we were over 24 or 25, we would be eligible to get married. I said, "Okay." And they wanted me to write down the name of the lady I wanted to marry and where her group stayed. I wrote it down, and they said, "Okay," and told me a date for the wedding. But on that day, when I went to the marriage office for the mass wedding, my bride-to-be never showed up. It turns out her boss, the lady, didn't want her to get married yet because she loved her so much. She told her, "Just wait till next time." This ended up happening 3 times.
The Recollections of Chumnyak, recorded at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland, here on a special co-production of the Signal and Maryland Traditions. After the break, Master Chum eventually finds his wife-to-be, but only after the collapse of the Khmer Rouge. We'll hear how they managed to make it to the United States and how Master Chum is keeping alive a now endangered musical tradition right here in Maryland. Stay with us. Welcome back to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program this hour, Music and Conversation with Cambodian Master Musician Chumnyak, recorded recently at his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Can you maybe say a little bit about what the story of that song is? What is that song singing about?
It's a man and a...
It's about a poor man and a rich woman who fall in love, but they can't be together. So they look at the moon, and they lament that their love is as impossible as reaching out and touching the moon. But they hope they might somehow be able to scoop the moon's reflection out of the water.
Live in the water, something we can touch in the water, and the moon if it cannot... take a moon from the sky, something like that. The mean like that, that song.
So even though he can't touch the moon in the sky, he can touch its reflection in the water.
In the water.
In the last segment of our program, Master Chum told the story of his unlikely survival during the brutality of the Khmer Rouge regime. In December of 1978, Vietnamese soldiers invaded Cambodia, forcing Pol Pot to retreat west and fomenting the collapse of his tyranny. Master Chum, like everyone else around him, found himself oddly and suddenly free of a four-year nightmare. The first thing he did was to seek out the woman he loved, the woman he'd been repeatedly barred from marrying. He found her, and they were wed, but the country around them was still far from stable.
After that, you know, the poor ran away. It became who want to do something, whatever you want.
After Pol Pot ran away, all of a sudden we could all do what we wanted. If you wanted to play music, you could. If you wanted to do something else, you could.
But I didn't go yet, because, you know, I'm staying.
But I didn't go back to my music right away, because I'd ended up becoming the father figure for a group of 35 orphans who depended on me for food and stability. My wife and I took them back to my grandfather's old family home to care for them. Eventually, we were able to reunite all but five of them with their families.
And my teacher is still alive.
In 1979, my old music teacher found me and came back into my life. He was still alive. And that's when I went back to music. We also started a trading business where we'd go to the border with Thailand and sell clothes and things for a little gold. My wife was pregnant at the time. In that area, there were still holdouts from the Pol Pot regime who were fighting, and it was a dangerous place. That's when the United Nations found us and brought us to a refugee camp. My son was born 2 or 3 weeks after we got to the camp.
That time, when we have a lot of people, they know me, they ask me, they say, okay, now, Mr. Chum, you're coming. I want me to play with the group for, you know, the dancer, something like that.
Once we got settled at the camp, other refugees started coming up to me because they knew of my musical reputation. They wanted me to play with a group for some dancers. So I played with that group. But I made time each morning to give lessons to the orphans. That's what I was most interested in doing. I taught adults, too. They came to me because I knew so many of the old Cambodian songs, and they wanted to learn how to play them.
That time, you know, when they said, okay, who want to go to the friend? Who want to go to Australia?
The UN people asked us, who wants to go to France? Who wants to go to Australia? Who wants to go to the United States? The representatives from France and Australia were really trying to convince me to go to their countries because they knew I was a revered musician. The people from the United States did, too, but I honestly couldn't even tell any of them apart. The people looked all the same to me. Cambodians call these people high noses.
High nose. I know.
It was a friend of mine who really convinced me to go to the United States. He said, it's a good place. I said, oh, okay. And I filled out the forms for the United States. After you do that, you just wait for the day when they call your name to go. My dancing group got called and they left for the United States, but I didn't get called to go until 6 months later. It was a sponsor from New York. I remember his name, Pong Kit. To this day, I still don't know who he was, this person who sponsored me to New York.
But they sent me go to, Indonesia.
But first, they sent me to a camp in Indonesia because they wanted me to learn what life is like in the United States. Things like how to turn electric lights on and off, how to use a bathroom. Because these were things we never had before.
Turn on the light, go to the bathroom, something like that, because, you know, we don't have something before.
And there was an English class. We stayed there for 3 months, but my group was already in the U.S., in D.C., and they sent me a letter telling me to come to where the group is, not to New York. I didn't know where any of these places were, so I went to an interview and I said, I want to change my arrival destination to D.C. They said, why? That'll hold up your arrival for a year. So I waited a year, and during that year, my daughter was born. But I came here in June of 1982.
Once Master Chum and his family landed at Washington National Airport, a refugee relief agency set them up in an apartment with 18 months of financial support. Chum would later take a construction job in Baltimore. But during those first 18 months, the newly arrived musician signed on as bandleader for a whirlwind U.S. tour with his old Cambodian dancing troupe. For him, it was a kind of culture shock in fast forward.
At that 18 months, I play music around in the United States and go to...
During that 18 months, I played music around the United States. We went to California and Florida to perform at Disney World and in Tennessee, in Canada, Pennsylvania, and New York. At first, I'd cry every night when I went to bed, thinking about my home and my friends and my life before. It was just so different in the United States. But when I played music, I realized, these are nice people. To them, it didn't matter that I couldn't speak English. It made me feel a lot better.
They took me 10 days inside Disney World.
They arranged for me to play music for 10 days inside Disney World. And I remember after the park would close in the evening, they let us go around and ride the rides when there were no lines. That was fun. But the first few days I was there, I couldn't eat the food because everyone was eating hamburgers. I'd never eaten a hamburger or anything like that. I'd only ever eaten rice. I remember crying that first day because they had us play two times during the day, and I could only eat a few bites of these hamburgers. I kept saying, I can't eat this. I was the band leader, and my friend said, you have to go ahead and eat it. You need your strength. But I remember one late night at the hotel, I passed a room and I smelled rice. I knocked on the door, and it was the wife of one of my fellow musicians. She had a rice cooker in her room.
Secret food.
Secret food. I was so happy. I was crying. I missed rice so much.
Almost cry and missing rice.
From a rural village in Cambodia to the inhuman work farms of the Khmer Rouge to a refugee camp in Thailand, and finally, to Disney World. Stranger than fiction, the story of Cambodian master musician Chum Nyak, as he told it to us, surrounded by the traditional instruments of his home country, at his current home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. I'm Aaron Henkin, here with Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, as we get ready to wrap up this incredible story, let me just give you a chance to put this man's musical and cultural significance in perspective. Just how rare and special is this man as a bearer of tradition? And what's he doing now to keep it alive?
Well, he's being very generous with his gift of music. He is a teacher, and he's also a performer for what's really one of the most, I guess, robust and vibrant Cambodian-American communities in the United States, which is in the Metro D.C. area, both in Maryland and Virginia. He performs and teaches at the temple, Cambodian Buddhist temple in Silver Spring, and he also is affiliated with another group in Arlington, Virginia, Cambodian-American Heritage Group. And one of the things that happened with the Cambodian resettlement was that really a significant number of Cambodia's most revered dancers and musicians were resettled here in Greater D.C. And so there's really a remarkable nexus of people that Chum Nyak is at the center of, all of whom are dedicated to teaching not only Cambodian Americans, but you know, people from outside of that, I guess, heritage community. And one of the most, I guess, prominent people in that latter group would be Joanna Pokori, who's an ethnomusicologist who really has taken a very important role in the community as a cultural liaison, as a teacher herself, as one of Chum Nyak's most significant students.
She is a very dedicated student. You mentioned that name, Joanna Pokori. She was actually at Master Chum's house on the day that we visited, and she had this to say about receiving the torch of this musical tradition.
The thing about learning Cambodian music from Master Chum is he teaches you to teach yourself. And if you don't know what you're doing, that can be a challenge in the beginning. So it's the work, it pays off in the end. The technique of teaching is basically the teacher demonstrates a little piece of the music and you repeat it until you get it. And then you have to remember that there's no notation. And I cheat by using recording devices. And I was in Cambodia a couple years ago, and everybody does this now, and people use their videos. So I think it's legitimate. But really, notation is not something that's used. And I think it's not used because it actually hinders the process. Because if you learn it the way they teach it to you, you're learning it with your body, and you're hearing it in your head.
When you learn in like a piece, one piece that you want to repeat and repeat.
When you learn a piece, you want to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Why? Practice. You have to train your hands. You know the music in your head, but your hands aren't as good as that. When you play it, it sounds different. You may say, why don't I sound as good as you when I play? Because I practice all the time.
Because, you know, I have a lot of time. I practice myself.
Practice, practice, practice. Final words of wisdom there from Cambodian master musician Chum Nyek. As we wrap up this week's radio program, a special co-production of The Signal and Marilyn Traditions. We want to give our gratitude to Master Chum for welcoming us into his home and sharing his story and his music. And in case you couldn't tell, Cliff Murphy, this is a man with serious credentials, a man who has been acknowledged in many ways as a true master of his music.
Yeah, and just a kind and generous teacher. He's been recognized through the Maryland Traditions Apprenticeship Award Program. We support him to teach students, but also he's been recognized with the NEA National Heritage Fellowship, which is the highest federal honor in the United States given to traditional artists. He's really not just revered locally, but nationally as well.
So we thank Master Chum. We also want to thank Master Chum's student, Joanna Picori, for her great help as a liaison, and also to Brett Jaspers of WYPR, who provided our voiceover work. Finally, Cliff Murphy, I want to thank you, sir, as always, for helping to give voice to these amazing bearers of tradition right here in our own backyard.
Thanks, Aaron. It's great to be here.
Chum Nyek's CD recording, which we heard excerpts of during today's program, is titled Classical Music from Cambodia. It's on the label Celestial Harmonies, and you can link to it at our website, wypr.org/programs/signal. That's also where you can link to the Maryland Traditions site, hear more radio collaborations like this one, and check out a full archive of The Signal, and of course, share your thoughts and questions with us. We'd be happy to hear from you. The website again, wypr.org/programs/signal. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.